So I've very quickly tried to cut out some things about my second lecture. And so if it begins to sound a little bit rambling, then that is the reason. But let me start right away. So in our first lecture this morning, we discussed four objections against the arts raised by Plato. And I mentioned that Christians variously rejected art because they considered them either superfluous or immoral, emotional, or deceptive. Now, when we narrow down our discussion now in the second lecture to the status of images vis-à-vis the word, we find that several of those objections still hold, but I won't go over that in detail. Having said that, Christian suspicion of visual art and images is not only informed by Platonic sources, but there's, of course, a source much closer to home, and that's at the center of the Hebrew tradition, and that is Exodus 20, verse 4, also called the Second Commandment, which stipulates that, and I'm saying this now advisedly in the King James Version, thou shalt not make yourself any graven images. Now, this commandment has been interpreted and used in very different ways by different theologians throughout history, and it's worth spending a little time on that to look at the exact meaning of this verse. So let's begin by unpacking what this second command actually says. When looking at the verse, we are confronted with essentially two sets of English translations. It turns out that older versions, including the King James version I just read, tend to stay close to the literal meaning of the Hebrew text. So they translate the word pezel in the Hebrew as graven image. More recent versions, including the NIV, tend to focus on its intended meaning. So let's see what the literal meaning is. So the key difference between these two translations concerns the translation of this Hebrew word pezel, or graven image. Now, first of all, the literal meaning is to carve wood or stone, and that clearly gave rise to the translation graven image. What is important to realize, though, that in scriptures the term is never used for a two-dimensional image, but always for three-dimensional objects or figures in relief, carved and chiseled out of wood or stone. Some of those would be covered with gold or silver, and later times it was also used for solidly cast sculptures forged out of molten precious metal. However, and it's the key point, whether carved, graven, cast or molten, the objects referred to were always associated with idolatrous and superstitious practices. So the only reason for making such a carved figurine was to use them for religious ends. And that is why almost all new translations, I think rightly so, have decided to replace the term graven image with the simple term idol. This meaning is also supported by the surrounding verses. If you look at verse 3, it says, you shall have no other gods before me. And then verse 5, you shall not bow down before them or worship them. So the Greek word idolatry, the Greek in idolatry, it literally means, it's a compound of idolon, image or figure, and latreia, which is adoration or worship. So it is the worship of idols. Now, the type of idol's figure it referred to could be small and portable, as the ones which Rachel carried when she stole them from her father's household gods, or large and life-sized. So, for example, when Michael used to trick Saul's men in believing that David slept in her bed, you may remember that, she took an idol, so it must be a lifestyle figure. Life-size figure, laid it on the bed, covered it with a garment, and then put some goat's hair at the head, so that when Saul's men came to capture David, she said he was ill in bed, and tricked them into believing that there was a human figure. So it's a bit like the Shawshank Redemption, those who have seen that film. And yeah, what we can learn from these examples is that whether large or small, many Israelites were still clinging on to such practices. They were still around in those households, despite their professed allegiance to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They nevertheless still hang on to some of the traditional gods. And in that context, it will become clear that the second command is not, as some forms of Judaism and Christianity, but also Islam, suggest, a blanket ban on representational images as such. It does not mean that Jews and Christians have to avoid making images altogether. It does not even mean that the images and art have to be restricted to abstract patterns or decorative designs. Because if that were so, it would be puzzling why God instructed Moses to include images of flowers and pomegranates and winged angels for the design of the tabernacle. What it merely means is that those images should not be put to use as idols. We may even conclude that the second command does not even forbid portrayals of God as such. We can only say that the text is silent on this point. If therefore we are to judge whether or not visual representations of God are allowed or appropriate, and we will come to that in a minute, we should look beyond the second command. In other words, there is in principle, and I say in principle, nothing in that particular command which suggests that we should not make a visual image of God. Having said that, in practice, there are of course various challenges in doing so. So how, we might ask, have artists responded to that challenge? Now let's start with depictions of God. It's very interesting that throughout the history of Western art, there are not many depictions of God. So clearly artists intuitively felt that they were faced with a big challenge. And clearly the main challenge was the fact that God is described as being invisible. So in Deuteronomy 4, Moses reminds the Israelites that they saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to them out of the fire. And again, this is followed by a warning against the making of idols. So if artists decide to go for any depiction of God, they have to employ a good dose of artistic license. And even so, there are various artists who have taken on the challenge and embarked on portrayals of God. Not surprisingly, most of these are based on the story of creation. And I will just show a few examples of that. So, of course, the most famous one, you might say, is Michelangelo's creation of Adam. And I'm not going to comment on every individual picture. These are merely to illustrate the fact that God has been depicted. So lots can be said, of course. The next one is three by Raphael, early 16th century, the creation of the animals by God. Then God, very wild one, separating the light and darkness, and here he is separating water and land. Then just a few years later, this is a Flemish artist, Simon Benning, the creation of Adam and Eve. Now, it's very faint, but you can see that Eve is lifted out of Adam's side. Then here we have Giovanni di Paolo, that is the expulsion from paradise, and again an image of God. And then here another famous one, which is Blake, God as an architect. So, Ancient of Days. So, are all these artists violating the second command? I don't think so. These are all portrayals of God in the context of the biblical narrative as told in the first book of Genesis. What is interesting is the consistency of his iconographical features, though. He's old, long-haired, and with a long beard. And this image has also lodged itself in the popular imagination. So we have a far side cartoon here, and again, it's the long beard and hair. So again, what this means for our understanding of God, we have to leave to later. But let me first continue our history. Now, whereas it has always been difficult to portray God as creator or as father, this all changed completely, of course, with the birth of Christ, the incarnation of God in human form. In Colossians 1, verse 15, it's written, Christ is called the image of the invisible God. So here we have an image, and in fact the word image for image is icon in the Greek. The original word for image is icon, where we get our English word icon for it. So Jesus Christ is the visible icon of our invisible God. Now, there is no shortage, of course, of depictions of Christ in the history of art. From the day of his birth, to his baptism, to his life on earth, to his death, and to his resurrection. And I'm just reminding you, basically, of all these. It is a couple of nativity scenes. This one is 1400, Lorenzo Manico, one by Giotto, and one by Hans Memling. And then here we have, coming up, a Christmas card. So, I mean, when we have, these are all depictions of Jesus. Then the baptism of Jesus. This is Fra Angelico in the monastery San Marco in Florence. One of the cells. Another baptism, Piero della Francesca. Then the life of Christ. Here we have a very early Christian wall painting coming from the catacombs where Jesus is seen talking to the woman at the well. Then here, a completely different style, but also the life of Jesus, and that is Jesus talking to Jesus healing a blind man. Then there are numerous depictions of the Lord's Supper, beginning and again with an early Christian one that it's called an agape feast, as it was at the time. Can you see this at all? Oh, okay, yeah, not too bad, is it? This one is by Giotto again from the Padua chapel, and very different depiction of the same scene. Here again, totally different, same subject matter, completely different depiction. And here, the very famous one by Leonardo da Vinci. Now we come to the crucifixion. Of course, I mean millions of pictures, and I just take a couple. An early Greek one, 1100, and mosaic actually. And then more quite famous one, Simone Martini. He lived 14th century. Another famous one, Marc Chagall, the white crucifixion. Interesting, done by a Jew. And then the resurrection. So we have Piero della Francesca here, and another very famous one, the Grunewald. Now, we could probably fill next week's, month, probably years, with showing pictures of birth, life, and death of Jesus, not only from the history of Western art, but Asian, African, Native American, and so on. This is just a sign of the enormous fertility of the subject for the Christian imagination, both in the past and now. Of course, over time, there have also grown strong conventions regarding the depiction of the subject, like the long hair for God, for example. And this applies particularly to the subject of the Virgin Mary, or when it's with an infant called Madonna and Child. There are literally thousands, probably millions of pictures of this quintessentially Catholic image. Mary holding baby Jesus on altarpieces, paintings, icons, and devotional cards. I just show a few. This is Cima Bue in Santa Trinita in Florence. There's Raphael, Madonna and Child. But just to show you that it hasn't lost its appeal, this is one by Chris Ofili. Now, how many of you recognize this, have seen this painting before? Okay, yeah. I'm not going to talk about it right now, but we might come to it later or otherwise in our next lecture. One interesting issue to explore is that of religious imagery outside the canon of the church, because not all pictures and paintings of Jesus or Mary are part of the high art network or the canon of Western art, as seen in the official galleries around the world. There is a whole, almost subversive world, you could say, of religious images, not only escaping the canon of the galleries, but also the confines of the church. And this is the world of devotional art, bought and used by people in their homes. Now, some of these pictures would be classified as religious kitsch by the art world, but that does not take away that the fact that these often play a very central role in the devotional lives of millions of people. So part of that belongs to a Catholic sensibility and is prevalent in countries such as South America, but there's also a whole industry of religious kitsch in the North American evangelical world. Now, the topic of religious kitsch is a very fascinating one, and I want to refer to a book by Betty Spackman, which I've put out. It's a wonderful way of approaching it, but it will need to wait for some other time. But I do want to show a couple of examples of images which are not easy to classify as art or as devotional images or as kitsch. So, beginning with this one. I think that is a devotional card, but based on the painting, and the same here. So you would not find this in an art gallery. Now here, a typical blue-eyed Jesus, and here a very famous one, Werner Solomon, that was done in 1940, the head of Christ. Millions of these were printed in small cards and given to soldiers on the front, so it had a very meaningful significance for people, and soldiers might be found dead and having a little card in their pocket. And this is what North American sensibility made of it. It would be a backdrop of a photograph picture, so a studio as did as their backdrop. Now, another way of portraying Jesus as a strong man in reaction to the more effeminate thing. Now, here, a very famous painting, Holman Hunt's Light of the World. Again, millions of copies and depictions and variations on it as well. Of course, this is part of high art, but other people would say, well, it's close to being sentimental and even kitsch. There's a variation on it. I don't know if you can see. He is knocking on the door, actually, not with a light, but with a gun. So this is a particular inspiration. And the final one is another variation on this very painting. So it just shows that images, there are numerous images outside the world of high art. And in fact, these are the ones we are more inclined to come across in journals or magazines or daily life than actually going to a gallery and seeing the real thing. Finally, I think we should say a word about icons. Icons are usually small, painted and portable panels, but occasionally also frescoes or mosaics, which depict holy personages such as Christ, Mary and the saints in a highly stylized manner. Now, they play an increasingly important role, especially in Eastern Byzantine church, such that their status of these icons came to be on a par with that of the cross or even the Bible as objects of venerations. So I just show a few icons. This is quite an early one, 600, Christ Pantocrator in Mount Sinai. The next one is 1400, the Byzantine one, Virgin and Child. This is by Andrei Rublev, who is one of the most well-known icon painters, Russian, 15th century. And then a final one from Crete, an icon Madonna and Child. Now, often we don't know the names of the artists, and Rublev is an exception, because it was typical of icon painters not to be drawing attention to themselves as artists. They didn't see themselves as the big romantic genius artists. In fact, they almost preferred their names to be going in oblivion, because it really was meant, the work, as an object to help worship. Now, as the name suggests, icons, the controversy it was precisely the role of icons which played in worship, which triggered off this whole debate about icons, and that's why it's called the iconoclastic controversy or debate, and that was the last several centuries. So let's turn to this debate now briefly and ask ourselves, what are the main issues in this debate and what can we learn from them? Because this lasted several centuries, and actually the debate is quite complex, we've got to always shift a little bit on what is the main issue. But I think there are two themes which we can distill from it. Now, first of all, there was a distinction made in the course of the discussions between, on the one hand, veneration or reverence, and the Greek word for that is proskynesis, and that was paid to holy persons, places and things, and so on. And adoration, that is latreia, and that was for God alone. Now, latreia, we already came across that word when we said idolatry. And so that is the kind of adoration which is reserved for God. Now, to our human modern ears, veneration and adoration do not sound all that different. I mean, we might think, well, they sound pretty much the same. But in their original languages, there was a huge difference between those two. So for someone to venerate an image, the first one, was to treat it with high respect, you could say, because it represented something which very highly regarded. But it was not to be adored, not to be worshipped for its own sake, only for what it represented. Now, all the councils agreed that whereas it was allowed to, and it even encouraged to venerate icons, they should not be worshipped in adoration, as that would verge on idolatry or superstition, because that was a huge element also in the discussion. They were used superstitiously, so that if we would kiss them or hold them with us, that somehow good luck would adhere to it, in the same way as one might carry relics around. One used icons in that way. Now, another argument in debate was that they could be used as teaching tools and images in general food. So Gregory the Great, for example, was the one who said images can be the Bible for the illiterate. And he stressed that images could provide a very useful teaching tool for those who were not able to read. It's probably one of the most quoted texts in medieval and Reformation discussions of images. And this was echoed by John Damascus almost a century later. He said, "Depictions of Christ and his life are a helpful reminder to us of his sacrifice for our sins." And he says, "It certainly happens frequently," this is literally taken from Orthodox faith, what he wrote, "that at times that we do not have the Lord's passion in mind, we may see the image of his crucifixion and, being thus reminded of his saving passion, fall down and adore." So it was felt that all in all, visual representation of biblical stories of Christ and of the saints were helpful means for Christians to worship. Now, a second argument to defend the use of icons happened also with John Damascus, who in 730 argued that since God had become visible in human form, it was also legitimate to depict him in a visible manner. And this was merely an affirmation of our belief in the incarnation. Now, that did not mean that the issue was settled for once and for all. Clearly, the issue continued to cause concern, and there were two more councils which had to issue official statements to prevent icons and paintings from being destroyed. So we had the Council of Constantinople in 870, and then years later in the Council of Trent in the 16th century. So the Council of Trent again felt it necessary to issue another statement called the decree on the invocation, the veneration, and the relics of saints and on sacred images, reaffirming once more the decrees of the Second Council of Nicaea. And let me just read this. The veneration of saints, relics, and images is allowed and to be encouraged, since it exists, the veneration of the original subjects. Thus, through these images, which we kiss and before which we kneel and uncover our heads, we are adoring Christ and venerating the saints whose likeness these images bear. Now, kissing and kneeling and venerating saints are normally practices we associate with the Catholic sensibility rather than Protestants. Which leads us to the next question. How did the Reformers position themselves on this issue? Were they on the side of the iconoclasts, the special of images, or the iconodules, the lover of images? So I was going to, and I will very briefly turn to these three reformers. I'm not going to do in as much detail I was planning to do, because I do want to keep some time for discussion. So I'm just highlighting the main things they said. Now, you have kind of a level of degree. Zwingli was the most negative. Calvin a bit less, and Zwingli, Luther was positive towards images. Let me say, so for Zwingli, Zwingli interprets Exodus 20 and the word as identical with idol. So for him, there are two ways which leads Christians away from God, and that is foreign gods and images. So by definition, an image of something, it is idolatrous in itself. And by placing images in a church or on an altar, is already giving them pride of place. Let's turn to Calvin. Now, Calvin is widely considered to be highly negative of aesthetic pleasure, or for that matter, any pleasure at all. And it is largely based on his negative view of images as expressed in the 11th chapter, really, of his first book of the Institutes. Now, what should be said, that is, Calvin is not against art. And interestingly, he uses the word art in the same sense as Plato did, as the word techne. So, later on in the Institutes, he mounts actually a solid defense of the arts, which both manual and liberal, and he calls these the good gifts of God's creation. And he even turns the tables on those iconoclasts which condemn all visual depictions, and he calls them superstitious. He said, "I am not gripped by superstition, by the superstition of thinking absolutely no images permissible. Images are allowed for teaching purposes or for pleasure, but only those of which the eyes are capable of seeing, either of real histories or events." So that was his conditional clause. You had to be able to see it in reality, and then you could make a picture of it. So you could not just use your fantasy or your imagination.
Plays and things would be okay, wouldn't they? You know, Shakespeare and so
on. What did he say on that? I have to pass on that one just now. My synapses are not connecting there. So he clearly, definitely believes that it's wrong that God should be represented. That's absolutely clear by a visible appearance. And his main concern here, actually, and this is important, and I will come back to it as well, was to retain a sense of God's majesty. So it was not even so much idolatry, but it was to retain a sense of God's majesty, as he felt that God could not be captured in an image. He said it was surely not less fitting than to wish to reduce God, who is immeasurable and incomprehensible, to a 5-foot measure. And he also says images are unworthy of God's majesty because they diminish the fear of him in mean and increase error. And these terminology is interesting because he refers here to the church fathers who warned against the idolatrous use of images, and the phrase to diminish fear and add error is actually from Augustine's City of God, who in turn borrows it from Varro. He also says that any use of images risks leading to idolatry. So he says there's something with... And we have to see this in context, because, of course, at that time, you did not have the kind of abundance of images which we have around. An image for us is not so important. But if you live at that time, and certainly before that, and to have a picture of something, and which is a natural representation, that becomes quite an important object. You know, it's like having only one photo of someone who you love very much. And that photo is going to be very, very special to you. So if you have one icon, say, of Christ, then this will definitely, in your household, get a special place and special attention and special respect and possibly adoration. You have to kind of compare it with that. It's almost impossible for us to think of something because we can't reproduce pictures. But say, you have only one picture of your mother left, and she has died. That picture will be treasured and be very carefully kept. But for Calvin, this also means that as soon as a visible form has been fashioned for God, his power is also bound to it. So it is linked to it. And he says that always leads to idolatry. He also rejects that it can be a teaching tool. In fact, he says, if the church would have done its duty and preached the gospel as it should have, there would be no uneducated people at all. We wouldn't need pictures because we would have done our job by preaching properly. Okay, let me turn to Luther. So, as I said, Luther is the least fearful about the use of images. He even says that God commanded certain images himself, and by which he means that God in the Old Testament used things like the bronze serpent and also the cherubim on the golden ark. He said it's not unbiblical to have images for memorial and witness, such as crucifixes and images of saints. This is clear from the Mosaic Law, and he also refers to witnesses of stone in Joshua and Samuel, and he calls them signs, in the same way that the image of Caesar on the coins would be a sign. And he says, since Christ seemed to have been unconcerned about those things, Caesar's image on the coin, why should we be so paranoid about images? But here, he agrees with Calvin and Zwingli that the worship of images is forbidden by God. But then he's also quick to point out that the worship of idols is not actually confined to the worship of external images. And I think he has an important point there. He says one can't have idols in one's own heart, such as a sense of pride or self-satisfaction. And one idol would be that we actually can please God with works, the typical Lutheran theme, rather than grace. And he said that that's actually an idolatrous thought that we... Now, interesting, the German Luther Bible also contains a great deal of pictures. I think I won't go into further detail there. Anyhow, so these three reformers, Zwingli, Calvin, and Luther, they raise a whole range, I think, of interesting issues, which are relevant to some extent, and certainly to our last section, on the difference between verbal and visual representation. And I will now conclude by making some comments on that, and what lessons we can have for the church. Now, the first point to make, so I'm going to make more general points now, not so much historic, but about the difference between visual and verbal representation. First point to make is that each is a very different form of communication. We are told that a picture is worth 1,000 words, yet when, for example, in the criminal investigation you have to describe a person, then you just wished that you had a picture there to have a quick point of identification. But if I would want to say a more complex sentence, such as I never thought that one day we would have a black president in the White House. Now just imagine how you would do that in pictures. That would be incredibly difficult. You could do the House and a black president, but I never would have thought that in the future. It's almost impossible to do that in a picture. So I don't know if anybody of you knows that game called Pictionary. Yeah, it's a fascinating game, because of course the easy ones are visible objects, which you can then. But the more abstract the word becomes, of course, the more trouble we get in. So it just shows that visual and pictorial and verbal representation each have different purposes, basically. And you can, in a way, with a picture, you can do certain things more complex, like making a face. And to describe a face is almost impossible in the way that a photo or a picture describes a face. But describing, well, an abstract term or a sentence where you said, I never would have thought that, is almost impossible in picture. So there are two different ways of communicating. Now, interestingly, pictures can sometimes close down meaning. And this was clearly Calvin's concern. But I think he's actually onto something. By allowing pictures of God, there is a real risk of domestication. The risk that we shape God into a familiar image, which then fits our culture and our comfort zone. And I think, say, the Larson, the cartoon, kind of makes that clear. So this is something which has become a convention in our depiction of God. An old man with a beard and long hair, which is now almost difficult to get out of our mind. If people, and also about the popular mind and the non-Christian mind. So God is that image. So in fabricating images of God, we do risk modeling God according to a particular image, and thus confining him to one particular conception, which may close down other aspects of his divine being. And there's something about pictures in general which does that. We're all familiar with the disappointment of reading a good book and then seeing a film, and somehow regret that we watched it, because we can no longer imagine the main characters in any other way than through the characters of the film. And in some way we almost feel robbed of the way we had imagined these characters previously in our head. I think there's also a risk with some films about the life of Christ, and including Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ, which I have not seen, actually, for that reason, that I almost hesitate to have that, because it is such a powerful film, I understand, that to have that as a dominating kind of image coming to me when I read the gospel story. So sometimes you have to guard yourself almost for not wanting to see particular powerful images, because it's very hard to get them out of your mind. Now, we can also think of the example of the blue-eyed Jesus, a far cry from what we understand is the gutsy Mediterranean guy we read about in the Gospels. And so such depictions not only close down other portrayals of Christ, but can actually be quite misleading, and especially also in missionary situations, and in especially in non-Western countries. I mean, just imagine having a blue-eyed blonde Jesus in a non-Western society. If that is the picture of Jesus they get, that is very alienating. And close to home, you may wonder how many young people have been put off by, say, Sunday school pictures, and on the basis of that decided that church was not for them. So even today, very few artists feel comfortable with depicting God or Christ, and I think sometimes for good reason, that they intuitively feel the pitfalls of it. And interestingly, the realm where there's least apprehension is the area of religious kitsch. So there are numerous images there, as if there's not quite the sense of that, what of the power of images. So that's the first point. Second point is that what is of course overlooked when I say all this about images is that words can have the same problem. It's not confined to visual imagery. So Calvin believes that we should not capture God in a visual image out of fear, but verbal descriptions of God and of dogmas are also forms of representation. It can be equally stifling and confining. I think, for example, of the texts of hymns or worship songs. If that is trivial or if that is alienating, or that is also creating, it's a representation of our understanding and our beliefs of God, which also is an interpretation. It says something about God, which is then going to ingrain itself in our kind of consciousness or subconsciousness and begin to lead a life of its own. And having said that, on the positive side, the Bible itself uses images, verbal images, for God, metaphors. Examples are God as Father, and Jesus himself addresses God as Daddy, Abba. And again, that's based on our own experience, and our experience of fathers. So it can be very damaging if we have a negative experience of a father. So that's why sometimes God is also called Mother in scriptures. And God is also referred to as King, but then also as Servant on the flip side, or Shepherd, or Lamb, and Fortress, and Counselor, and Judge, and Comforter. And you could say that the sheer diversity and seemingly paradoxical nature of these images, king and servant, shepherd and lamb, may suggest that we could never confine God to just one of those. So I think there's a reason why there are contrasting images, because it shows one dimension. Mm-hmm. So if you see God only as king, we are in trouble. But if you see him only as servant, or only as liberator, or only as judge, so there are all these variety of images to build up a picture of who God is. And these pictures, verbal and visual, because of course, when we think of shepherd, there is a visual element to them. They connect with our lived experience. They can enrich and supplement, and at times correct even, our more abstract conceptions of God. So they can affect the way we actually relate to God. Third point, this is about the visual-verbal divide. And just to make the point, which I made at the beginning, that it is not a division between artistic and rational, or feeling and rational. It's much more complex. And we have non-artistic pictures, such as pictorial signs, and we have artistic words, poetry. So the situation is a bit more complex. And both visual and verbal representations can be exploring and ambiguous, but also very clear and conventional. So both work on a spectrum, you could say, alongside. Now, a lot more to be said about that, but I just want to throw that in as something to keep in mind. Then I already mentioned it, the changed status of images and words in our society, and the fact that we live with an image saturation. And that we look completely different at a picture now, and hardly look at it. I mean, with digital photography, they have become so little worth really, pictures that a completely different social culture we live in now. Now, let me conclude with some comments on the church and visual representation. And my first point is that the fact that, as I think is true to say, that there is a lack in the scripture on a ban of visual representation or images as such. So we are free to make images, rather. It does not mean that therefore we have complete license to do any image we like. Sometimes in churches who have come to see that it is good to include visual imagery, they now go, everything goes. So the banners and pictures. So I would say there are still criteria for images, both aesthetic and artistic, but also theological. We have to be careful about what kind of image we put in our worship spaces. But I'm not even convinced that all our images need to be representational as such. So when we talk about bringing art into the church, it's not necessarily putting paintings on the wall. I think it starts at a much more fundamental level, and that has to do with our total aesthetic and liturgical experience. So it's the worship space. Does it have a sense of space, or does it feel cramped or confined? Is it inviting or off-putting? It has to do with the rhythm of a service. Is it staggered or bitty, or does it have a flow where we can enter an inhuman kind of rhythm of the stages in the liturgy? You could think of the poetry, of the words, the language, the music, of course. I mean, we can have a whole course on the music interior, but again, that is part of the aesthetic side of within the church. So we could even think about items, say the way we celebrate the Lord's Supper. Is it with a chalice or a homemade kind of cup, or is it with these little cups, or just to have some thought going what that means, how do we bring these items in, and what kind of visual experience do we have when we go through a worship service. So I think there's in many evangelical churches which I've attended myself, there's a deep liturgical neglect of that aspect. Okay, finally then, and it takes us to a slightly different subject, and which I will talk about more next week, which is the use of Christian iconography, Christian images. And I had one picture of Phyllis, Madonna, who's not a Christian. The questions that raises, how do we respond to that? Do Christians have a privilege on using those images, or should we allow and even welcome non-believers to explore those too? And what do we feel if those images do not stand for what we think they ought to stand for, or are even offensive to our beliefs? So that is just a taster for next week. And we do have time for discussion. I'm putting my glasses on and I can see who is talking.